Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Mary Norris, and we're talking about her latest book, Greek to Me, Adventures of the Comma Queen. Mary, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to talk to you, Mark.
Now, for my listeners, I want to say this is a wonderfully written book, and you really need to read it, not just talk about it. So after you've heard us talk about it for a half hour, go buy the book. Because I don't say that about a lot of books, but there are certain books where the writing really matters, not just the subject matter, and this is one of those cases. I love your description about how your passion for Greek language, the Greek mythology, the Greek landscape developed, because you had some odd elements in there, it's including Sean Connery.
Ah, yes. Well, Sean Connery, I mean, it reads like a joke, but it was the actual experience of seeing Sean Connery in the movie Time Bandits playing Agamemnon, battling a Minotaur, that made me want to go to Greece.
I wonder how many people that movie affected. That's like, there's all these tourists who like somehow saw Time Bandits and went, yeah, Sean Connery, I want to go there and see that.
Well, I didn't expect to see Sean Connery, but I did, you know, it was the scenery that I fell in love with. And I later found out that the movie was shot in Morocco.
Doink. Oh, well. It's interesting because even later in the book, you write that you get literally an erotic thrill every time you return to Greece. There's a feeling. There's a physical, palpable feeling.
Yes, and also every time I return to the language, even when I'm not in Greece, if I take a quick course in Greek at the new school or someplace in New York or go to a tutor, I just get very excited.
Well, let's talk about how you started to pick up the Greek language, because didn't you originally go to learn Latin?
I wanted to learn Latin when I was a child. There was an offer from the nuns when I was in about fifth grade for some of us to study Latin on Saturdays. And I asked my father if I could join that class, and he refused to let me.
I find your father an odd character.
He was tenacious, my father.
Okay.
And I think he himself didn't enjoy classes in things like, he had to stay with an uncle who was a classicist up in Canada, and I don't think he enjoyed being force-fed like Greek mythology or Latin proverbs, and I think he was probably trying to save me from something that he did not enjoy himself.
Had you read Edith Hamilton as a child?
No, actually, no, I don't know. I got most of my mythology from the movies.
Oh, so Jason and the Argonauts.
That kind of thing.
Yes. Okay, all right.
And the movie Ulysses with Kirk Douglas.
I can't believe you referenced that movie. A lot of people don't even realize that movie was made, because you don't see that a lot anymore.
They showed it in New York last Christmas. I went and saw it again. It's pretty funny.
Well, isn't it an Italian production?
Yes. It was Dino De Laurentiis.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So that's where you got most of your mythology. So how do you explain this developing interest in Greece? Where did it trace it for me?
Well, you know, the movies are powerful. but something, it must have been that I began to read the epics. I must have read Homer in translation. When I was in high school, I was in a production of Sophocles' Electra. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until I got to college, when I was a sophomore in college, I had finished up all of my requirements, and I started to look around in the catalog a bit, and I saw a course in mythology, and I just thought it sounded exotic and impractical. By that time, I was really into taking courses that were impractical. So I took, and it turned out to be a wonderful course taught by a woman named Froma Zeitlin, who later became famous. And I was at Rutgers then, and she later moved to Princeton. And her approach to mythology was based on, like, some kind of French structuralist school.
Oh, wow.
So it was just fascinating. She made it really come alive, and she made me believe in the Greek gods the way I had ceased to believe in my own religion of Roman Catholicism.
Well, first of all, it's a lot more exciting.
There's a lot more personality.
There's more monsters and cool people in Greek mythology.
And they're flawed. I love that they're flawed.
Yeah, that's what the heroes are all about. They're not quite gods. They're not quite human. And they're just messed up all in between.
Right. And they give you hope.
Yeah, they do. You don't get that a lot of other religions.
Certainly not from Calvinism.
Now, a lot of... No, by definition. Now, a lot of people get enthralled by Greek mythology. But for you, it sort of snowballed into learning the language, the written language. And that's a complicated process.
Yes. For me, it went from just chatting or trying to find my way around in Greece with a minimum of modern Greek to studying ancient Greek when I got home and really delving into it, reading tragedies by Sophocles. I read Antigone, and I was in a few of the plays in ancient Greek. They have a tradition of performing those plays in ancient Greek. And reading the Symposium and the Apology of Socrates. It's just, you know, there's a reason these things are classics. They're really wonderful.
So what was it, talk to me about the difference between reading them in translation and then actually reading them in Greek.
Well, the Greek, certainly if you're talking about Plato and you're talking about Socrates, Socrates' speech is very informal and full of life. And it comes across in the Greek in these little words called particles.
Mm.
We would call them function words, I think, is what a linguist would call them in English. There are the words like okay and you know and like, the words that parents are always trying to keep kids from saying, actually. don't you know? Socrates is always talking like that, and you learn the meanings of the particles. And what is hard is to get across the force of those in a translation, because the temptation is always to translate them stiltedly.
Right.
And he was, you know, Socrates did not speak in a stilted fashion. I'm sure of it.
There's a really nice section in your book about Homer's use of epithets. And if you've read the Iliad or the Odyssey in translation, you're familiar with phrases like crooked-minded Cronos, swift-footed Achilles, gray-eyed Athena. What's the story with Homer and epithets?
Well, it was conventional to have these descriptions. Epithet just means adjective, but it also is an indication of character of some kind. In Homer, they say that it was just a space filler in a lot of cases, because there are different versions of the epithets that fit the rhythm of the line. When it's translated, there's no way that English can copy that rhythm without sounding like, you know, somebody from Mars has written an epic. So they get tossed around a little freely. Everybody has to decide what to do with those epithets. But I love them. My feeling about them is that they do have some inimitable meaning in them, something
right.
that is really hard to get at. Even one of my favorites is the rosy-fingered dawn.
Well, when I read that section of your book, I'm one of those people who, when I read that in translation in the Odyssey, I did expect that if I went to Greece, I would see rosy-fingered dawn. And you actually sort of broke the code on that by traveling to Greece, because you expected the same thing.
I did, and there was a, you know, I got up on the ship. I wanted to go and see the dawn. I got up really early, and I went out, and it was an overcast day. But I looked, I kept my eyes on the east, and finally there was one little, I called it a knuckle, a rosy knuckle of dawn. But later in my reading, and I can't take credit for this, there's a writer named Adam Nicholson whose book, Why Homer Matters,
I've interviewed
mentions
Adam.
This. Yeah. Have you? Oh, he's quite wonderful.
Yeah, he is.
So he made the point that it's not long fingers stretched out along the horizon, although dawn can look like that sometimes, I suppose. But what the fingers do is touch the high things first with their pink light.
Oh,
and
man.
That's what the rosy finger of dawn is. It's touching things And
things that are tall and sort of spire like the tops of evergreens, the tops of mountains.
Rocks up at the tops of mountains, yes. I live in New York City, and there's a few tall buildings out my window.
And there's Rosy Fingered Dawn lighting them up.
There's just a few minutes when, on a nice day, I get this beautiful red glow at the tips.
Well, you know, I want to thank you for that moment in that book, because it made sense to me once I read that. Well, Wine Dark Sea is another one.
Yes. That's when I realized while I was on a ship in the Aegean and thinking about that, you think of wine as purplish, right? You think of the grapes. I know there's white wine too, but wine dark, you think, well, that must mean red wine. And then why is the sea called that? It's not red. It's not purple. And then I realized it's not about the color. It's about the quality.
Wow.
And so wine dark means mysterious and a little bit dangerous and something that you can get lost in.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Mary Norris, and we're talking about her latest book, Greek to Me, Adventures of the Comma Queen. You also get involved in the actual alphabet, the Greek alphabet, and there's so much that was fascinating about that section. One of the things is that they believe that the Iliad is the first work of literature ever recorded in alphabetic writing.
Yes.
I loved learning that.
That's a bit controversial, because, of course, no one can prove any of this. You know, I suppose maybe they could find some piece of rock or some inscription somewhere that would indicate it, but it just is circumstantial evidence that the alphabet developed at the same time and around the same time that Homer was written down. So there is a school of thought that the alphabet was developed specifically to write the epics down.
Now, the Greeks developed their alphabet from the Phoenicians?
Right. Yeah, the Greek genius was that they added vowels. It's always been called, from the Phoenicians, it was aleph, bet, and those sounds have stuck all the way through till now. And, you know, we're talking about things that came from like 11,000 B.C., the Phoenicians, a long time. So clearly the alphabet was something that, it has lasted, it has been incredibly useful, and it's very adaptive. So that's what the Greeks did. They adapted it and put the vowels in. And that's what gave it its real life. You know, you can't have poetry without vowels. You really can't have you can't really imitate speech without the breath that is behind vowels. And also, that made it song, right? That made it singable. You can't sing the letter K.
What's amazing about this book for me is that you'll have these very lyrical passages, and then you'll explain why John Belushi in his bit on Saturday Night Live goes cheeseburger.
cheeseburger.
You know, and the great thing is you explain it. It's like, well, what a guide to have to go on your trip to Greece. This is what I'm looking for.
Well, you know, it was very difficult to write the chapter on the alphabet, because the first temptation was to start with A and then go on, you know, through all the letters. And there is nothing more boring. I had to keep cutting passages with examples of words that began with K and trying to make them sensible to an English speaker. For instance, there is the car brand, the Korean car brand Kia, K-I-A. On the backs of their cars, they just write K-I, and they take the horizontal bar out of the A, so it looks like a lambda, the letter L in Greek. So those cars are spelling out kill.
Whoa!
If you know the Greek alphabet, yes. That's what it says.
You even decode Animal House's frat. Delta right. Tau Chi. Well, you know, these are, you know, the pleasures are big and small in your book, and I never realized that every frat and sorority, when you looked at their three Greek alphabets, that actually stood for something else, and you couldn't find any frat to tell you what the secret code was.
They're very serious about their secret codes.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Well, Phi Beta Kappa, the original one, they advertised it. It meant, well, Philosophia Kybernetis Bio. No, I've got it mixed up, but I have the letters in the wrong order. But it meant philosophy is the joy of my life, is the guide of my life. And that was a study group, a Greek study group, that was very serious about studies and the beauty of philosophy and language. The other, it is a little bit deteriorated.
Now, reading ancient Greek, for me has always seemed very complicated because there's no punctuation marks and it's all uppercase.
Well, we have had it decoded thanks to wonderful librarians at the Library of Alexandria back in the early centuries AD, I think. But originally when they wrote it down, you know, they invented the alphabet. What can we expect of them? Also to have invented editors? And so they did not have punctuation. They had only capital letters at first. And, you know, one form of punctuation, the most obvious form that nobody thinks of as punctuation is space between words.
Right.
And they didn't have that. They just ran them all together. They didn't have periods at the end of sentences. When I think of it, I realize that the only way you can have possibly known what it meant is if you already knew what it meant. That would help you read it.
So are people weren't reading these things for pleasure in the same way we would?
Like, oh, sure they were.
But they just sort of already knew what the inscription would mean, say on a black figure pottery or something.
Probably. They probably already knew. And there was a time when the epics were still oral and they had already developed the alphabet. So there were both things going on at once. That would have formed, I guess, a transition.
Let's talk about mythology a bit before we get to your first trip to Greece. Do you really identify with Athena?
Well, I love Athena. I think I identify with Odysseus in a way.
Huh.
You know, we all do. We're all striving to get somewhere in life, and that's what he's there for, a model of persistence and of cleverness, of versatility and adaptability. And Athena loves Odysseus and guides him and gives him advice. So I liked Athena for that, and I liked Athena for how much she liked Odysseus.
But the way that you describe her, it seems like you really appreciate her qualities of being unfettered, and your own phrase, beholden to none.
Well, she does seem to me a good example of an independent woman. I don't know what Greek women might have gotten out of her back in those days. But certainly she had devotees. But she was not married. She had no mother around. And, of course, she is given a mother in mythology named Metis,
yeah,
who was one of the Titans. And Zeus swallowed Metis while she was pregnant, and Athena was born from Zeus's head. So she seems to be like pure thought. There's something about the idea of even her birth. And she was born fully grown, fully formed, and armed for battle. So she's kind of, one of the translators calls her like a teenage prince, sort of. You know, she was ready to do battle the minute she was born.
When you finally start taking your trips to Greece, which are described in this book, it's really interesting when you have read the history, the mythology, and you try to match up the geographical actual locations with what you've read. And when it starts out with the Eleusinian, Eleusinian mysteries? I always mispronounce that.
It's hard. I would say Eleusinian.
Eleusinian mysteries. I have always been really entranced by reading about those, but it seems like we don't know anything about what goes on there.
It's true. They were supposed to keep it a secret, what went on, you know, the people who belonged to this cult. And it had something to do with acceptance of death, because Demeter and Persephone are the ones who are honored in the Eleusinian mysteries. And Demeter, is the mother of Persephone, who was raped by Hades and taken to hell as his bride. Hell is not exactly what the Greeks meant. Of course, it was different. But, you know, it was kind of a January-May marriage, and nobody had agreed to it except the brothers Zeus and Poseidon. So people would walk in procession all the way from Athens to what in modern Greek is pronounced Elefsina, and now it's an industrial city. It's kind of a terrible place, but I didn't know that until I had walked there for myself, hoping to see the flowers of spring, and instead I saw lots of petrochemical factories. But it is frustrating because a lot of people went on this pilgrimage, and they took very seriously the injunction to secrecy. And there's speculation, but nobody knows. Nobody would admit what happened. They couldn't get it out of anyone. They couldn't torture them and make them admit what happened.
Did something happen when they got there?
Well, when they got there, they had they all went into a big hall, and there were priests, and they drank something. They drank a potion that was their way of communing with the goddess, and it was originally. They think it was made from barley because Demeter was the goddess of grain.
Right.
And then there's speculation that it was barley that some kind of bacteria had grown on, and it was actually LSD.
Oh, I know about this. Right,
yeah.
Right. It's like, that's the reason they also thought that there were the danse macabre in the Middle Ages.
Oh.
Because of ergot poisoning that was found in the communal rye supplies.
That's it, ergot.
Yeah. Wow. Your trips change as the book progresses. Your first trip to Greece, you had this incredibly ambitious itinerary. And then as the reader goes through the book, it gets more languid.
Well, I was desperate to see everything the first time I went, and I had 5 weeks. I had 4 weeks of vacation, and I borrowed a week from the next year, and I wanted to go around the Aegean and go to the places that are associated with the Trojan War. So those were along the coast of what is now Turkey. But in the old days, Asia Minor was part of Greece. You know, they were seagoing people at any place they took a boat to, they settled in, basically. So there were large Greek communities in Asia Minor. Byzantium, Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, was originally a Greek city. So I wanted to see all of that, and I wanted to see things that are on mainland Greece. So I took, a very hectic trip. I wouldn't go on a cruise. I wouldn't go anywhere where somebody else wanted me to go. You know, I had to go at my own pace.
And you went by yourself?
I did. I went by myself. Took a big detour to go to Cyprus that trip and made it up to Istanbul and then over to Thessaloniki. I visited a lot of the islands in the Dodecanese and Crete.
But as the trips go on, you seem to spend more and more time at every location.
Well, I had been hoping to mature into the kind of traveler who likes to soak up the place that she's in instead of just, you know, dipping your toe in and then leaving. So, yes, I would spend more time in places as I got older visiting. Well, what happened was that sometimes somebody would go with me. Nobody I knew would keep to my schedule. If I wanted company on a trip, I would have to spend a little more than 3 days in each place, make it a week or so. The final trip that I take in the book, and it is the last time I've been in Greece, I hope it won't be the last time
I was going to ask you about that, because there was almost a sense of finality that I was hoping wasn't going to be true.
Oh, no, I do want to go back for sure, but the last trip that I took was it was a long trip. I spent a whole month on the island of Rhodes and a month on the island of Patmos and then another month traveling, but spending, you know, a few days more than I used to in places, and finally a full week in a place called Kardamyli, which is in the Mani, a peninsula off the Peloponnese.
Where the author Patrick Lee Fermor.
Exactly.
I have not read anything by him, and now because of your book, I'm going to have to pick up some of his. He's sort of legendary for people who love Greece.
Yes, well, he's one of the great English travel writers. He was also a war hero, so he has a lot of dash. And he's a wonderful writer. He wrote a book about the Mani, and that is called Mani, and one called Roumeli, which is about northern Greece, about his travels there. And he's really a master of the catalog. It must be a modern version of the Homeric catalog of ships. Remember that from Iliad? But what Patrick Lee Fermor does is just make lists of things that, of different kinds of dancers he's seen, but he has one famous list that is about the Greek diaspora, the way Greeks have gone from Greece to every corner of the world. And I counted, because I was curious, there are 91 different kinds of people, kinds of Greeks living in different places that he describes. And the lists don't flag. They don't run out. They are actually crescendos. They get more and more interesting as they go on.
You also get to bathe nude where Aphrodite was born, which was pretty poetic. That was pretty poetic, man.
Well, that was something I didn't set out.
No, you didn't.
To skinny dip. But it seemed like a good idea.
Great idea. It was really brave, too. But it was.
Well, to drive around in that place alone, I suppose, was brave. But I didn't think of that at the time. I just thought, I want to see this beautiful place. And I'd been told that this beach was the beach where Aphrodite used to swim, and that if you swam around some rocks, you would be beautiful for the rest of your life. So who could resist? What woman could resist that?
What anybody could resist that? So did it work?
I don't know. I had a
judging by your writing, it worked. Your writing's pretty beautiful.
Well, I can tell you this, that when I came out of the water after that swim, it was a beautiful, luxurious swim, you know, very slow and voluptuous, and the water, I actually tasted the water at some point. Yes, I did take off my bathing suit because I wanted to be completely enveloped in the water. And when I got back to the beach, to the sand, everything looked more beautiful to me than it had before. Everything was transformed. You know, it could have been the salt water in my eyes. I don't know what it was, but it was a real blessing. It was a wonderful sensation.
It's like this book. My guest tonight is writer Mary Norris, and we're talking about her latest writing, Greek to Me, Adventures of the Comic Queen. This book takes many digressions in all sorts of different directions. It's a very wonderful read. Mary, thank you so much for your time.
Wonderful talking to you, Mark. Thank you for letting me share.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.